This is Danny and Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Streaming nationwide on the 710 Sports app and 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
By the way, on the show.
Hey, it's Danny
Gallant.
It's Friday. It's not hump day, but it is another bump day. Let's bring in Michael Bumpus for Blue 42.
Here we go.
This is Coors Light's Blue 42.
We're going to go red, right, tight, close, sprint left, G, U corner, halfback, flat, on two. Ready, right.
Blue 42 is brought to you by Coors Light. The mountains turn blue at 42 degrees.
Blue 42.
Now here's your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Blue 42. Blue 42.
Morning, Bump. How are you now?
Good morning, fellas. I'm doing all right. It's Friday. The weather is decent, and I'm here talking sport with you guys.
I like it. I like it. Well, we're about to talk about perhaps a travesty that has taken place courtesy of the mothership ESPN. They put out a list of the top 10 running backs in the National Football League, and guess who wasn't on it? Chris Carson. Did they get it wrong? Is Chris Carson a top 10 running back?
You know, initially I'm like, what are these guys doing? Chris Carson, he's rushed for 1,200 yards. He's fifth, I think that's fifth most in the NFL. You know, he's reliable for the most part. He got hurt towards the end of the season. He breaks a lot of tackles. And then I start looking at the list. And I see guys who are in front of him. I see a Josh Jacobs that's in front of him. I see a Mixon that's in front of him. And I'm like, well, what do those guys bring to the table that Chris Carson doesn't bring to the table? And I see Saquon over McCaffrey. In my opinion, McCaffrey's the best running back in the league. He does the most for his team, 1,000 yards rushing, 1,000 yards receiving. So I start trying to look into the eyes of ESPN on this thing. And I think they made this list based off of talent. Like, what does it look like when the football is in their hand? Yes, they need to have stats, rushing yards, and touchdowns, and whatnot. But what does it look like when the ball is in their hands? And there's a quote by an NFL exec. It says, really good in short yardage. He's talking about Chris Carson. Three down player, just not really a dynamic big play back. So, okay, what would make him a big play back? What's his longest rushing? What's his longest carry last year? It was 58 yards. You got about 10 guys in front of him as far as longest rush. And then I look at what he does out the backfield, catching the football. Only 266 yards catching the ball. Now, you look at the NFL today, a running back has to be able to catch the football. So I would say Chris Carson is a top five running back in the Seattle Seahawks offense. If the league ran the offense that the Seattle Seahawks run, he'd be a top five running back all day. But now you look at the rest of the NFL and what the majority of the NFL does. They're spreading it out. They're getting running backs out the backfield. They're catching footballs. It looks a little different. So I'm looking through the eyes of ESPN. Initially, I'm thinking these guys are crazy. Chris Carson's a top five running back. I just look at the landscape of the NFL. I'm okay with it now. He's on the honorable mention list. I think he deserves it at least to be on the honorable mention list. But it's all about what offenses like to do in this league. They like to spread it out. Hawks don't do that. So that's how they make their list. What can he do in a spread offense? I don't think they're thinking about that double tight, you know, that big boy offense that the Seahawks run. So, you know what? At first, I thought they got it wrong. I think they got it right. And another thing that hurts Chris Carson are his fumbles. He had the most fumbles as a running back last year. He had six fumbles. I think three were lost. So he has to take care of the football. A lot of these guys are taking care of the football. Plus, he has 75 first downs. That's second in the NFL. Why? Because short yardage situations. You hear that NFL exec talk about Chris Carson in short yardage situations. So, overall, I give him a top 15 running back in the league. In the Seahawks offense, he probably does it better than a lot of people. The overall spread offense, I'm okay with him being on the honorable mention list.
Is he the team's leading rusher this year? They signed Carlos Hyde. We don't expect Rashad Penny to be healthy at the start of the year, just based on the nature of that injury and that it was it wasn't just an ACL tear in his knee, unfortunately. There was more damage done to it. Do we think Chris Carson ends up being the team's leading rusher, which would mean he stays healthy and he remains ahead of Carlos Hyde on the depth chart?
Today, I don't think he is. I think they're going to ride Carlos Hyde. I think they got him for a reason. He rushed for 1,000 yards last year, and it's the uncertainty with both your horses back there and Chris Carson, Rashad Penny. You just don't know. You got to go with the guy who's been there, done that, Carlos Hyde, and was proven last year, and who's coming in healthy. just because of that. Now, if Chris Carson never had that injury, and if Pete Carroll today said Chris Carson's ready to go, he's 100%, I say he leads the team in rushing. But I think Carlos Hyde is going to get every opportunity to be the number one guy. And I'm okay with that. Chris Carson can come in later and back him up and have a little 1-2 combo, and I'm good with that. And I think that's probably the best way to go because it brings him along slowly. You're not asking him just to carry the team. And we know how Chris Carson runs. He's not going to try to make anybody miss. He's going to try to run through you. He runs aggressively. So I'm going to go with Carlos Hyde to lead this team in rushing.
Question two. So they're going to play 60 minutes of tackle football, 3 hours. But as soon as the game's done, Bump, we're going to have enforced social distancing. They don't want players going and kibitzing with each other and exchanging jerseys. We're not going to do any of that because that's just not safe. It looks silly. It kind of seems weird that you're going to try to legislate and reduce contact after they go out and play football, tackle football for 3 hours on a Sunday afternoon.
It's ridiculous. These guys, okay, so what is tackle football? It's a lot of guys hugging and grunting and sweating and spitting and all this stuff. They're going to do that, but then after the game, keep your 6 feet. I understand social distancing, but on a football field, there is no social distancing. These guys are literally going to be giving each other hugs all game, but after the game, you don't want them to exchange jerseys. This is just a PR move. NFL just wants to look like they're doing the right thing. We're trying to make sure all these guys are healthy and we have their best interests in mind. I think the NFL cares if these guys are healthy or not, but come on, man. Let's be real. The damage is already done. If someone's going to contract something, he's got that thing in the second quarter on the third play on a 10-yard, on the 10-play drive. He didn't get it after the game swapping jerseys with somebody. So it seems silly to me. I think that's something that they kind of have to say and have to put out there for PR, for perception, so people can be like, oh, the NFL, they really care about their guys. Look at them. They can't exchange jerseys afterwards. But for 60 minutes, go ahead and get at it and knock each other's brains out and rub sweat on each other and spit and all that stuff. So it's silly to me. I get why they're doing it, but, man, let guys exchange jerseys.
I have an idea for the NFL broadcast. So we can keep jersey exchanges, but what happens is both players have to go to the laundry room, put their jerseys in the washer, and then sit there and have a conversation with each other about what they appreciate about each other's games. And they just have to sit there awkwardly for, like, you know, however much the rinse cycle is when you've got a jersey, and then the drying cycle as well. And then, boom, it's clean. Clean jerseys, we're fine.
Now, that would be a strong PR move right there. You can even make it into like an after-game segment. Laundry with Sherman and Russell, you know? Make a whole spectacle out of the thing. It's just, it's silly, man. I get what they're trying to do, but you're signing up to take a risk. You're risking your life when you play football. You're risking your health. Football's a risk all around. You're adding another risk to it. Not being able to exchange jerseys isn't going to change the outcome of anything, in my opinion.
Yeah, I completely agree with you, Bump. And as you're describing it, because I get the thought process, which is, look, we're having to modify as much as we can, and we're going to reduce contact in all situations where it's not necessary for the game. Like, that's basically what it's saying is that, okay, we can't have it not be tackle football. But to try and make it as safe as possible while playing tackle football, let's not. It would have been much more effective if they would have just said that to the players. Like, if you had just said, like, hey, guys, here's the thing. We think it's actually a little bit extra risk that you don't need to take if you exchange jerseys, and here's the difference. But because they put it in rules, what it looks like, and this is the way, an attempt at PR actually, I think, makes the NFL look worse. Because what it looks like is the NFL is like, you know what? For those 60 minutes in which we can make money off of your efforts, we're not going to do anything to be even slightly worried about whether or not you get sick. But the minute those 60 minutes are done and we can no longer monetize and make money off of your efforts, we want you to put yourself in a bubble and don't talk to anybody and don't you get sick. Because if you're going to get sick, it better be while we can monetarily benefit from it.
Control, control. That's all they want is control. That's the NFL for you.
If you could have traded your jersey with anyone during your time in the league, who would you have done it with?
Randy Moss all day. I mean, Randy Moss. I believe he was still playing when I was in the league. Randy Moss is just
a freak.
I mean, the guy has a football term named after him. My son goes outside, he plays football with his cousins. He comes back in, he goes, Dad, I mossed my cousin today. I'm like, I'm so proud of you for saying that, son. You know who Randy Moss is. I mean, the guy has a football term named after him. Randy Moss, one of the greatest of all time. I would stand in line to exchange jerseys with Randy Moss.
One of my favorite bars ever is in the song by Outkast, The Whole World, where in the middle of the song, it goes, I catch a beat running like Randy Moss. I will actually fast forward to that part of the song. Randy Moss in New England was a lot of fun. Yes, there were some shenanigans before and afterwards, but that's a good one, Bob. Question three. The Ivy League has shut down all fall sports. We saw the Big Ten announce yesterday that they are going to only keep fall sports in conference, no out-of-conference games. Do you see the Power Five following, though, the Ivy League's way? Because, man, they shut everything down, and we still got a couple of months before a lot of those sports were going to start.
I can see the Power Five getting there. I mean, you're dealing with young adults. In our eyes, they're kids, right? 18 to 22-year-olds. When you put them at risk, talk about PR. I mean, that's a horrible PR move, right? We're going to put these young men and women at risk to make some money. Forget their education. Forget all this other stuff. It's all about sports. So this is a bad move. I think slowly but surely, the Power Five is going to get there. And I think all it takes is one Power Five. And especially, let the SEC do it first. Oh, it's a wrap. The big daddy of all football. If SEC cancels their season, cancels all fall sports, everyone's going to fall in line. So it's kind of like everyone's just sitting there. Who's going to make a move first? So like, yeah, the Ivy League did it. Those smart guys. But, you know, they're weird. They do things differently over there. Let's not really take them serious. Like, we're gonna pay attention to them, but they're not going to determine what happens with this football season. You got to have the Big Ten. You got to have the SEC. One of the top dogs make a move. The Pac-12 is going to sit back and chill. They might be the last ones. Like, look, all right, guys. I mean, we're Power Five, but we're kind of like the fourth or fifth Power Five. And we'll just wait and see what the big homies do. And then we'll follow suit after that. So I think it's going to get there eventually. When you're asking young kids to go out there and take a risk, it just looks bad.
You know why the Pac-12 will wait? West Coast? We're a little bit more relaxed and chill out here. You guys are a little too uptight. Yeah, we'll just kind of wait and see how this corona deals with. See if it blows through. Check it on out. We'll get back to you in a week or so. I kind of like that we're a little more relaxed about things on the West Coast.
Yeah, I like it too. You know, we'll sit back at the beach and we'll wait to see what everyone else does, and then we'll wait last minute. You know, it's like traffic out here. You're gonna get to wherever you're going kind of late or right on time. Like, you're gonna wait last minute to make a decision. It'll be like a Thursday. You know what? Forget it. We're gonna cancel the season. It's over with. We'll see what the Pac-12 does.
Now,
are those? I'm new to the West Coast. Are these West Coast vibes? Do they encroach on everything? Like, well, hey, we're relaxed. Maybe we're not going to get the things on time. Because I have this term called Southern time, and I feel like I've become a part of it since moving to Florida and living in Texas, where I end up being like 15 to 20 minutes late for everything.
It's not being late. It's not being late. It is not stressing. Like, it's not being so hung up of, like, what are we going to do right now? I want to know exactly right now. You're like, okay, just let it sit there for a second. Like, you don't need to have a decision right now. Like, you need to decide right now what you're going to do in a month and a half. Like, no, we'll just wait and see. It's kind of constant game time decisions. That is West Coast.
Yes.
West Coast is constant.
Are you
going to be out tonight? I'll see. Like, it's non-committal. it's generally like, are you going to come through here? Maybe. Let me know what you're doing. It is non-committal, sort of leaving things open-ended. That is West Coast.
I have a planner.
That
so I'm late
perfect.
To everything. But
yeah.
Wow. I like the opposite of the two-minute drill.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I'll see. Hey, come on, hurry. Why? I might get there. Dude, don't be stressing me. Like, come on. What's your problem for being so uptight?
It feels a little Andy-esque, though.
This is the West Coast. Back in my clubbing days, right? In Cali, last call is at 1:30. The clubs close at 12. Why are we getting here at 12:30? Like, why are we getting here at 12? We should probably be here around like 11, 10:30. But no, we show up late. It's all good. No rush. We'll have an hour and a half to chill. That's just, it's the West Coast mentality, man.
Yep, that's exactly right. That is Blue 42. It's brought to you by Frost Brewed Coors Light. We were talking about this yesterday, Bump. I thought that college sports were going to go through an overhaul when players started getting paid. And I think that the writing's been on the wall in terms of especially players in revenue sports like football and men's basketball. We're going to get some form of compensation, that some of it was going to be reworked. And I thought that was going to create massive change across athletic departments. I actually think it's going to be the coronavirus. We saw Stanford eliminated 11 programs. And I think that's going to be something that comes out of this, because as football seasons begin to be impacted and the Big Ten, ACC, and a lot of other conferences saying they're going to eliminate non-conference games at the very least, college athletic departments could look very differently in the not-too-distant future, because football pays the bills for an awful lot of things on campus.
Yeah, football is, think about football, right? It brings in the most money. It starts off the school year. Like, it sets the tone for the rest of the year. And students go to schools based off of their football programs as well. You know, I don't know the exact numbers, but I like to think that since Nick Saban's been at Alabama, enrollment has probably been up. When Urban Meyer was at Florida, enrollment probably was up. Even at Wazoo, when Mike Leach was there and we went 11-2 or whatever it was, enrollment probably went up. So football sets the tone. I think that's why people are so hesitant to really cancel it out, because there's two kind of stories to this. There's the revenue part of it, and then there's the health part of it. I'm sure these directors and these commissioners have ran the numbers. If we don't have football, this is how it affects the rest of our athletic program. And they got to make a business decision. Are we willing to risk losing, what, $6 to $10 million? Those teams that go to the college playoffs, even more than that. And how does that affect the rest of our athletic program? You got to make a decision for the masses right now. And the worst part is, you're going to offend somebody. Someone's going to be mad at you. You're not going to get this thing right. You got to be able to deal with whatever comes after this. You get the kids out there and you play, people are going to call you crazy. Why are you getting these kids out there? If you don't play, you're hurting our athletic program. What are you doing? So these commissioners are going to make their money this year, man. It's going to be a tough decision. But without college football, funding for all the other sports are going to go down, and it's going to suffer. You're going to see the quality of play. You're going to see recruiting. I mean, I'm sure they have a nice little savings account to get them through a year or so, or maybe half a year, but you're going to feel the effects of football isn't playing.
It seems so inconsistent, though, because some of these places are just doing online classes. The Ivy League at Syracuse, this is something where I went to school that has been broached, that not only are there going to be online classes, but some of them are going to take place on Saturday. Things are shifting, and I'm not saying that college football players, maybe at that university in particular, are going to have those classes on Saturday, but it doesn't feel consistent with what the actual universities are trying to do. And while I get that it's a money-making venture, I don't know how you sell everybody on this, because from a PR perspective, which perhaps shouldn't matter as much as it does in 2020, it doesn't look great.
You're right. And I actually think that this is exposing a contradiction that we've always known. Like, we've always known that college football and college basketball players they're students, but they're student athletes with an emphasis on the athlete part. Like, there's no doubt that they're getting educational opportunities, but they are there and are brought into school, and everything around it is geared toward having them fulfill a function that's kind of like a worker. Like, as a football player, and you're it's very similar. It's more demanding than any job I had when I was in college. And so you get into these situations where, okay, we want to take the money from the students while limiting their class time. I mean, at Harvard this year, you're going to pay $50,000 for tuition, and you're not going to set foot in a classroom.
Insane.
Crazy.
But football players at these big schools, like, you can't have remote football. Like, you can't. So they're kind of like, well, okay, so everybody we're going to take the money from, we might not need them to be in the classes. Like, maybe we can get away. But the dudes that need to come here so we can generate money off of them, hell yeah, we've got to get them on. And so there's that contradiction that I think is being fully displayed. I completely agree with you, Paul. How can you not have classes on campus and bring football players to campus so they can play football, and then say, well, you know, they're student? No, they're very clearly a different category of athlete, of student, because you're making money off of them. And is that even ethically consistent with being, like, that's, if I was a football player, there'd be a part of me that, like, okay, I want to play. But there'd also be a part of me like, what the hell? Like, my health isn't as important as other people's. Like, it's not safe enough for all the other students to be here. But hell, not only are you going to come here and go to class, but then you're going to go out and tackle dudes from other parts of the country on Saturday.
This is exactly why guys need to get paid. This is it right here. This is why. Because they generate so much money for these universities. And these universities are really considering putting them at risk because they realize that they don't, that without them, the revenue is down. So when people ask, oh, why should athletes get paid, especially football players, why should football players get paid? I'll tell you why they should get paid. All right, because they're up at 5:30, they're at weights at 6:30, they have class from 7 to 1 o'clock, they have meetings from 2 to 3, they have practice from 3 to 5, then they have film study after that, then they have to go to study hall, do group projects or whatnot. It's because they're asked to do a lot more than the average student. I'm sure there are students out there who have rigid schedules and our expectations are high, but they necessarily don't have to do those things. As a football player, you have to do it. And if you don't do it, they will kick you out of school. You miss a practice. I dare you to miss a practice and not communicate. I dare you not to go to class. I dare you not to go to study hall. They will yank your scholarship. You're gone. The average student, yeah, I won't go to this Thursday class, hour and a half. I don't feel like going. I'll make up the work. No one says anything to you. Like, you are under a different set of rules.
There's no doubt about that. And that question... So we're going to see this change happen in college programs, I think. And some of it is going to be, I think football players will start to get a financially, I don't know if it's going to be fair market value, but they'll start getting paid. I think that'll happen.
Yeah.
But that money is going to go away. The impact it's going to have is that money's not going to be going to some in the administration, some in terms of the development, but it's also going to impact the scholarship opportunities in other sports. And I'm not sure what sports is going to look like, college sports is going to look like a year from now. I'd be really sad if athletic departments became only about revenue sports. But there's also a part of me that really wants to see, like, how big is your athletic department's administration? Like, how many people are making executive salaries because the football players that generate the bulk of your budget are not getting any sort of salary. And the NCAA, like, that's the one. I'm sad that Stanford lost its fencing programs along with another 11. Like, it's not a huge deal, but look, we're better off having fencing in the world than not having fencing. But I'm not going to, the one thing, close the NCAA right now. Shutter the entire building. Like, raise that thing to the dirt. Fire everyone employed with the NCAA. If there's going to be cutbacks, like, those are the sort of things that should be just absolutely decimated first, because there's way too much administration.
It's a bunch of administration, and they're getting paid a bunch of money. That's why they're not going to shut this thing down. They're like, nah, man, I want my $250K. What are you talking about? Let's see if these kids can get out there. And there's people getting paid more than that. Money talks. I know people say this is an amateur sport. It's a privilege. Yes, it is a privilege. Thank you, Washington State, for giving me the opportunity to play football and live out my dream and get an education. Thank you. But this is a business. You were printing number 5 jerseys for a reason when I was there. It wasn't because I was garbage. It's because I was making plays. You know, you were flashing my name on the big screen out there when people were yelling. It's not because I was garbage. It's because I was making plays and I was bringing you money. And thank you for allowing me to bring you money. But you also could have helped me out with a check while I was in college and made my life a little easier. It's all about money. Call it what you want. It's about money. And I think athletes now are more aware of that. And because they're more aware of that, they're going to start putting more pressure on these guys upstairs making money.
Bob, have you ever thought about what you should have actually earned while you were in college? Like, have you ever put a monetary amount next to it?
You know what? I never put a number to it, but I would look in the crowd and I'd see number 5 jerseys and I'd go, hey, just give me 5%. 5 to 8%, and that would change my life. I mean, Washington, it's cheap as heck to live in Pullman. Just give me 5 to 8%, and I'm balling. I might go out and pay a tab for everyone at a bar that night. You know what I mean? It just make life easier. I don't have to get rich. I am getting an education. I am getting provided an opportunity to make more money, but you're clearly exploiting my services right now.
I like the idea of trickle-down bar economics.
it is Danny and Gallant. Fox Sports came out with a list of the top 4 defenses of the past 10 years in the NFL. The Seahawks are on it. They're just not on it enough. We'll explain next.
You're listening to Danny and Gallant,
powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios
on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Oh, we're just having the conversation about how much the head of the NCAA makes. And it's Mark Emmert, who's the former UW president. He used to be the UW president. He's also someone whom Jim Moore referred to in print when Jim was a columnist at the Seattle PI. I believe referred to him as Fife Boy. because he was from the city of Fife. And Mark Emmert is most known for an incredibly luxurious head of hair that he has. Absolutely incredible.
It's nice.
It's a great haircut. He's a great head of hair.
I believe Jim Moore has been referred to as the guy with good hair.
That's true.
So, Moore's
got nothing. They're in the same camp. No, Moore's got nothing on Emmert. It is luxurious. I said 1.5 million. I said 1.5 million, and I thought that was solid. I would have said that my degree of certainty was like a solid 50%. I was so low. According to USA Today, during the 2017 calendar year, he made $3.9 million. $3.9 million to release statements. And this was the statement that we heard from the NCAA this week. As the COVID-19 pandemic continues to impact college sports nationally, the NCAA supports its members as they make important decisions based on their specific circumstances and in the best interest of college athletes' health and well-being. They provided a statement of support. They didn't say anything. They just said, "We support our God."
I know you pay us to make decisions. You pay us to make decisions. We're not going to make any. We're going to sit back and see what happens. Let's roll the dice. Let's see what happens.
Give you support. You have our support. Thanks, Mark. We appreciate it. Fox Sports, I first saw this because of Bruce Irvin this morning. Fox Sports had a poll that it posted, and it asked to pick the best NFL defense of the past 10 years. And the Seattle Seahawks are on the list. Of course they are. 2013 team, which I think most of us recognize as, yeah, that is the best of the defenses they had over the past 10 years. The 2015 Broncos are on there, also a Super Bowl champion. The 2018 Bears and the 2017 Jaguars. This shouldn't be a question. And I honestly think, if we're being honest, I think the Seahawks have two and maybe three of the best defenses over the past 10 years. They definitely have two. The 2014 Seahawks defense should be on there. Like, there's no doubt in my mind that if you were going to say of the four, and I think the first one I kick off is the Jaguars. Like, the 2017 Jaguars, they went to the AFC Championship game. If I look back, like, they were 10-6. Now they have Blake Bortles as a quarterback. They gave up more than 35 points twice. Like, if you give up more than 35 twice in a year, can you be considered one of the best defenses of the past decade? Like, that's getting hammered. That's getting run on.
Well, they're good quarterbacks in the AFC.
35
they did go up against the Steelers offense
twice.
Okay, but if they don't
also,
get
they
robbed,
also play in,
they
also play in a pretend
touchdown.
Division. They also play in the MAC.
They almost got to the Super Bowl with Blake Bortles as quarterback, and if not for an inadvertent whistle, that defense might have taken them to the Super Bowl against the Philadelphia Eagles. Because remember, Miles Jack definitely had a fumble return for a touchdown, and the refs just blew the whistle. So I wouldn't take the Jaguars out here, Danny. I would take the Bears out. Who cares about the 2018 Chicago Bears? No one. They are irrelevant. The Bears have been an irrelevant franchise for my entire life. They don't belong on that list at all.
They won 12.
If I'm taking anyone out, I'm taking out the Jags. I would take out the Jags, but I got to respect the Jags, too, just because of what you said, Paul. I mean, Blake Bortles, the pressure that defense was under to not have guys score. I mean, yeah, you gave up a 30 bomb a couple of times, but the pressure they were under was crazy. And, Danny, you said you don't think the Hawks are on there enough. Are we getting snooty up here? Are we finally reaching the point where the Seahawks are, you know, are the Seahawks fans taking on the Patriots kind of persona where we walk around with the nose up and say this is the greatest defense? I mean, once is enough. So you want to kick a team out and throw another Seahawk defense on there. Reaching another level of privilege over here, or whatever you want to call it.
100% correct. I am embracing my defensive privilege. I went and looked. So the Jags, that 2017 Jags team, they give up 35 points twice in 16 games. Three seasons from 2012 through 2014, so 12, 13, and 14, Seattle only gave up more than 35 points once. Just once. So that's 3 years. And also, at the end of the 2014 season, you look at their last six games, Seattle's last six games, they held opponents to single digits in five of them. Like, this is the big pass-happy league. I guess my big objection is that this makes it seem like it's a choice among four teams. There's no choice here. Seattle, for four successive seasons, allowed the fewest points of any defense in the league. To present them as an option and not the overwhelming favorite, like that they are the, of course, it's the 2000. This should not have been a question. It should have been a coronation about the best defense of the past 12 years.
I can get with you on the body of work argument for the Seahawks defense, but I'm about to say something that I think is going to rile Danny up. That 2014 defense was really good. It also blew a 10-point lead in the Super Bowl. And I feel like that weighs it down a lot. Now, this list that they put together, it only features two champions. So you can make the argument that, yes, that Seahawks defense definitely better than one of those two. I can get with you there. But I feel like that definitely takes away from the 2014 team. And I know that the body of work leading up to it was fantastic. But I make the same argument for that Atlanta Falcons offense that we saw a couple of years ago in 2017. If you look at their numbers, like one of the best offenses, honestly, that we have ever seen. But they lost the Super Bowl, and I feel like that, because of that, you sort of fade off into oblivion because you weren't able to get it done. And you weren't able to hold on to the lead, and you weren't able to score more points in both of those cases.
Richard Sherman was playing with one arm at that point. Earl Thomas had to undergo shoulder surgery after that game. Cam Chancellor suffered a sprained knee several days in practice before that Super Bowl to the point they didn't know if he was going to play, and he still managed to knock Julian Edelman so silly that if I was a really petty person, I would say that the officials erred in not yanking his concussed butt out of
concussed.
The game because he was absolutely hammered in that play.
Was.
And not only that, but Jeremy Lane, after picking off Tom Brady in the end zone, then ended up getting his arm broken, a compound fracture, and tore his knee ligaments on the same play, and all that had to happen before they blew a 10-point lead in the second. So while you're technically true, like, that's some pretty extenuating circumstances that it took to lead up to
I agree.
That.
Yeah. How many people do you think actually know that, though? You think they're like, all the injuries you just named off, right? No one knows that. Only the people in the Northwest, the real 12 fans, really know that. So I think I appreciate your argument, but it's 2020, Danny. Everyone gets a ribbon. Everyone gets a trophy. You can't just take up all the spots in the top defense, Danny. You got to give someone else a chance, right?
This is how we get to the point where the head of the NCAA makes $3.9 million in a year. Then all of a sudden, everybody tries hard, and he's doing the best he can. And because he gets up there and has a great haircut, we need to recognize everybody's accomplishments. And yes, the 10-win Jacksonville Jaguars should be listed in the same size font as the 2013 Seattle Seahawks, who went and put a 35-point whooping on a team. You remember the storyline going into that? This might be the best offense ever. This might be the best. Oh, get hammered all of a sudden. Demaryius Thomas has a dent in him. They're snapping the ball over the quarterback's head, and he's saying he should have gone silent. And at the end, they're like, huh, was that really the best defense of the past 10? Yes, it was. Come on.
No win did I enjoy more for a team that I had no rooting interest for at the time. I sat back and just cackled with glee that entire game because I thought there was a real chance Peyton Manning was going to win that Super Bowl, and he got killed.
Destroyed. It is Danny and Gallant. Ugo Amadi is up in the slot. We're going to hear what he learned from his first season there and ask Michael Bumpus about this team's secondary going forward. That's all ahead.
You are listening to Danny and Gallant.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
On 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
I wasn't here for the Ugo Amadi show in last year's Seahawks training camp. My real memory of Ugo Amadi this past season is mainly what could have been a fumble return for a touchdown against the Carolina Panthers. That was called back. But he also had some issues when he was thrown into the fire against the Green Bay Packers. And when he was on Joe Fan's Talking Seahawks podcast, he explained that watching that Packers game back was tough.
I think the most important thing was being able to watch it after the game. You know, whenever you don't feel like you did well, it's hard for you to watch it. Because everybody loves to watch themselves doing good, but it's hard for them to watch themselves doing bad. And I watched that play and that game so many times. I actually watched that game. It's funny. I watched that game last night, literally. I watched it again on my iPad. And, you know, life is all about losses, you know. And I always listen to Mike Tyson's podcast, and I read his book. He said, man, you know, you can't win them all, but the only way you get better is if you lose. If you don't lose and you win all the time, you know, you don't know what you have to prepare for, what you have to get better at, you know.
I did want to focus on Ugo Amadi continuing to watch the Packers game over and over again, but let's pause for a moment because he's
Excuse
reading
me?
Mike Tyson's book.
Excuse me? And watch and listen to his podcast? Look, I'm as big a Mike Tyson fan as you're going to find. Like, Mike Tyson is a defining sort of athlete in growing up, but I'm not sure is he the kind of person that you want turning to guidance when it comes to, like, how to focus yourself for the opportunities at hand. He's been a little bit erratic over the course of his life.
Yeah, a little bit. He's older now. He's wiser now. You know,
yeah,
are we
sure?
he's focused on farming and on pigeons.
But there's and I know that he's kind of lovable now, and he was in the Hangover and people, but at the same time, like, this is a guy that said he wanted to eat Lennox Lewis's children. Like, that's
what you want out of a nickel corner, I think.
No, I don't. I want him to be able to not give up the sideline fade. Like, I want him to be able to have inside leverage. I don't think I want to have someone who's thinking about how we can devour someone's offspring.
I do like hearing back, though, that he's been watching this low moment of his career. It was a tough game for him over and over again. He said that it's his job to lose that nickel corner spot. I wonder if that's 100% true. I've been trying to think of who the alternative is at nickel cornerback going into this season. I don't think it's Trey Flowers. I don't think it's Quentin Dunbar. I feel like one of those two is going to win the number two corner job opposite Shaquille Griffin. I don't really feel like he's competing with anyone at that spot.
If he's competing with anybody, I'd say is Marquise Blair. You know, they might roll him down. And honestly, I think whoever doesn't win that right corner spot is going to compete for that nickel spot. And I think it might be Trey. Trey's body, I feel like, isn't really built for that interior type position. You know, you got to be kind of thick in there. You're going to get bumped around and stuff. But I like Ugo Amadi's mentality. And I give mercy to the kid. That touchdown he got beat on, that was a route concept that I've never seen. It was two receivers to the left of him. And usually what receivers do when they have a crossing pattern, like one runs a slant up high, one runs a flat underneath, and you try to get these corners to communicate and overlap or whatnot. They fake that. So instead of overlapping, they kind of like meet at one point and then disperse to the sidelines. I can guarantee you that Amadi's never seen that before. And I guarantee you that the Packers didn't put that on film either. So it was a tough one. It forced him, and I forgot who it was. I think it was a safety that was down helping him. I forget who it was. But it forced him and that other Seahawk to communicate. And then it's Adams, man. Adams is one of the best receivers in the league. His body language was beautiful. He saw that number 28 rookie standing over him, was like, man, taking lunch money, easy. So I appreciate him going back and looking at the film, because that's tough. I mean, when I dropped a punt in the NFL, we were playing against the Rams, and that was the hardest thing for me to watch. Go back and watch myself drop a punt on the 10-yard line, and thankfully the defense held him to 3 points. So, and Ugo Amadi's already done way more in his career than I've done. So I could imagine him going back and having to humble himself and watch that. He's doing the right things in the offseason. You got to be honest with yourself.
That's got to be a tough one. Catching a punt is really difficult, though, Bob. I feel for you on that, especially if you're watching that back. Like, what can you really do when you're watching that back? Catch it next time. Oh, gosh, that's got to be brutal.
What's interesting about Amadi is he's not built like your typical Seahawks corner. Like, they've had a template for the kind of guys that they get in there, and he's different. And I think it's because of the type of player he is that they see him as a potential playmaker. It has been interesting to hear Pete dangle the possibility of Marquise Blair coming up and playing nickel, because that's never been their MO, is to put a safety type guy in that spot. Like, they've always moved a corner, and even when they've had a guy that's on the outside and Therald Simon came in nickel situations, they play Therald on the outside and then move whoever it was to the inside, like if it was Jeremy Lane. So I'll be very interested to see what they decide to do with that spot. I think Pete's trying to create as much competition as he can, but I'd be real surprised. I thought Amadi looked very confident, and hearing the way he talked about sort of looking at objectively how he performed, that's what you want to hear from a player.
right? Like, that's the perfect explanation for it. Now, the real measure is, does he come back and is he able to improve? Does he make the same mistakes? Does he learn from it? But as far as, like, that's exactly what you want to hear from a rookie. It's not like he is intimidated by the shortcoming, but it's not like he's ignoring it either and pretending that everything was just fine. And like, he recognizes it as something he needs to improve on.
Yeah, you know, it's he started week one. I think people forget that sometimes. He started week one against the Bengals. Bengals almost beat. Did they go into overtime? It was a close game, if they didn't go into overtime. And he got torched. You know, and I think that's what kind of made Pete Carroll kind of move away from him. He's like, goodness gracious, this rookie, he's going to kill us. But at the end of the day, him not being able to work through that stuff early is what hurt him late, I feel like. So he's going back and he's doing the necessary things. I just hope that Pete Carroll plays these guys young. Get Marquise Blair, put him in multiple positions. Ugo Amadi, give him chances to grow. Trey Flowers, like, you got to keep these guys on the field early to get these reps late. We know that Russell Wilson's going to win some games on his own, especially early. Now, when teams start figuring guys out and personnel out later on the season, you're going to have to rely on that defense a bit more. So get these guys some reps. I love Ugo's, his personality. I like the way he thinks. I like his approach to this thing. And I think he's going to be successful. Just when he gives up a play, because most DBs are going to give up plays, that's just the way it is, let him work through it and don't sideline the kid.
I'm wondering what the Seahawks see in him, if they see a comparison. I look at his body type, and it's interesting you mentioned, Danny, the size at cornerback, because it does jump out. He's 5'9 and not even a half based off of his combine measurements. He's a guy who had punt return touchdowns in college. He's a guy who had interception return touchdowns in college. A couple of tackles for a loss, some sacks, fumble recoveries, forced fumbles as well. It sounds a lot, all of that, to me, and the size on top of it, like maybe there's poor man's Tyrann Mathieu inside Ugo Amadi, and maybe that's what they're looking for and hoping for, that they can have this little tiny guy blasting and speeding around the front levels of the defense in addition to, when he's called upon, covering slot guys.
Is there a comparison there, Bum? Do you see between them? I've always thought of Mathieu as more of a safety and not a guy who's going to turn and run with people. But I can see there's no doubt that Amadi looks different than the kind of players that they usually scout. I've wondered if he's someone Pete Carroll's mentioned before. Aaron Glenn was a corner that he had with the Jets. I believe he was out of Texas A&M. That if he's someone that they see as that type of pretty explosive playmaker athlete.
Yeah, I see some similarities when it comes to like physique. You know, I think Mathieu was a little bit taller than Ugo. They're both thick, but Mathieu just sees the field. I mean, he can be on the right hash and see what's going on opposite of the field and feel it and anticipate it. And I guess that's why he's a Pro Bowler, right? I think Ugo Amadi, he has field awareness. How do I know he has that? He was a returner. When you're a returner, you're back to returning punts, returning kicks. You almost have to see everything in like two snapshots. So we know that he has that ability in him. It's just, are the Seahawks willing to take a risk and take some lumps along the way and letting him see all that space? Because I'm telling you, man, the NFL game is fast. I thought USC and Auburn were the fastest teams I ever played against in college. I got to the NFL, and Lofa Tatupu and those guys were the fastest defense I've ever seen, and we weren't even that good that year, you know? So the game definitely speeds up. I think he has the ability to make plays in space, but it's all about opportunity. Is he going to get these opportunities, and what do you do with these opportunities, and how patient is Pete Carroll? If the Hawks don't make a move in the secondary, I think this guy gets these opportunities. Now, if they go and get a Jamal Adams, I think things change a bit.
Real quick, would you make the trade for Jamal Adams?
Definitely. At this point, I'm just, look, give me a name. Give me something to believe in. Make this defense better. I don't care what position at this point. Give this defense a name, make them better, make the 12s happy. I'm going after Jamal for show.
Okay, well, we're going to continue this conversation, but Michael Bumpus, we appreciate you joining us on Bump Day in the 8 o'clock hour and on Fridays. You have yourself a wonderful weekend, buddy.
All right, guys, talk to you soon.
It's Danny and Gallant with Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant. Michael Bumpus, again, joining us in the 8 o'clock hour every Wednesday and Friday. Coming up next, that is the big rumor on these streets right now, that Jamal Adams is potentially a target of the Seattle Seahawks. Should they make a trade for him? We'll discuss that next.